My name's Bob Smith, and I'm an enthusiastic member of Al-Anon. I came into this organization 22 years ago. I came like most Al-Anons. I love an alcoholic. My wife, Betty, who died about 2.5 years ago, was a sober member of Alcoholics with 19 years of sobriety when she passed away. And believe me, folks, for those 19 years, I am truly grateful. And I know there's some of you that understand that, too. I think to be an Al-Anon, you're not automatically an Al-Anon just because you're associated with somebody that's in the AA program. I think it requires some work on your part. I think I must need to live the steps. I think I must need to abide by the tradition. I think I must need to attend the meetings regularly, and I think I must need to have a sponsor. And I do these things. And my first sponsor was a woman. And I know we don't encourage sponsors of the opposite sex, but I looked around, and when I came in, the only guy there was about the age of my son, and we didn't have too much going. And this lady was even older than I, and you can tell by looking at me that this sex thing is not nearly as large a problem as it might be. But anyway, she has remained my service sponsor all these years, and I'd like to be able to tell you that I jumped right into service, but that's not the way it happened. She goaded me into it. And I've been the GR, and I've been the DR, and I served 3 years with the West Texas Assembly. And several years ago, I got a call from our central office asking me if I would consider applying for the position as trustee at large for all of Al-Anon. And I seemed to have the educational qualifications for which they searched and the business experience that they wanted. So I talked to my group and prayed about it. And I picked up the phone and called them, yes, said, yes, please put me down as a candidate for trustee at large for all of Al-Anon. Guess what? I didn't get it. Oh, don't we hate rejection? But the point I want to tell you is that my program kicked in on me and came to my rescue and said, hey, whoever got that job was the one that was needed at that time and was capable of doing a better job than I, and perhaps my Heavenly Father had something else He wanted me to do. And I'm totally free of that. And that's what my program does for me when I let it, most of the time. We're going to have a happy time. You know, these are happy programs, serious programs, but happy programs. Although I have only been Al-Anon 22 years, I am the only person still living who was present when the two founders of Alcoholics Anonymous met for the very first time, Akron, Ohio, Mother's Day, 1935. And I rode out with my dad and my mom, my dad's Dr. Bob and my mom's Ann, and I rode out with them to meet with Bill for the very first time. And I want to take you back, if I may, in my memory, to those times. Now, my dad had come home the Saturday before Mother's Day with a potted plant, set it down. He was potted. Went upstairs and passed out. But my mom was a friend of Henrietta Cyberling's, and Henrietta called and said, Ann, there's a man out here that thinks he can help Bob. Bring him right on out. Well, Mom had to explain to Henrietta that Bob was in no shape to talk to anybody, but she said, I'll get him out there the next day. Well, as we rode along, he had a terrible hangover. And he said, okay, 15 minutes of this bird is all I want. But it wasn't 15 minutes. He and Bill went off in a room by themselves, and they talked for many hours. And as a result of that meeting, and at my mom's invitation, Bill came, and he lived at our home all that summer. And this is a time and place that Alcoholics Anonymous was started. Now, what I want to talk to you about today, I want to talk to you about starting from nothing, because perhaps there's somebody here who is at the stage in their life right now that think that they're starting over from nothing. And I want to talk to you about what I consider to be miracles, because perhaps there's somebody here that is in bad need of a miracle. And I want to talk to you about recovery. I'm not going to talk about the difficult times. I'm going to go on the basic assumption that everyone in this room already knows how to be miserable. Okay, so we'll take it from there. It was in the middle of the last Great Depression, and we lived in a one industry town, Akron, Ohio, and they made tires. Goodyear, Goodrich, General, Firestone, Miller, Cyberneck, all were made in Akron. Well, when people stopped buying automobiles, they didn't need tires. And the rubber shops went down to maybe 2 days a week, the people that still had a job. And there were strong men on the street corner selling apples for 5 cents apiece, trying to support their families. And it was a very hard time. We would have been kicked out of our house for non-payment of the mortgage because we could no longer make the mortgage payments. But President Roosevelt, in 1933, declared a mortgage moratorium where people like us were allowed to stay in their homes. Otherwise, we'd have been out in the street. And that's the shape we were in when AA started. Well, of course, Bill didn't have any money either. But I think these guys had two things going for them. They both had open spiritual minds, and they had the desire to be of service to another human being. Now, they couldn't have raised 50 bucks between them, I'm sure of that. But they set out to find another alcoholic to see if they could help. And the first one I remember was a young guy by the name of Eddie R. And Eddie just been thrown out of his house for non-payment of rent, along with a cute little blonde wife and two stair-step kids. So they moved the whole family into our house, locked Eddie upstairs, where he'd be available as they got this knowledge. Hey, you got to remember that nothing's written. They're just trying to stay a page ahead of Eddie. But Eddie was an agile young guy, and we had downspouts. And Eddie would open the second story window and slide down the downspouts and escape. And they had to postpone Eddie's recovery long enough to recapture him. Can you imagine a more inauspicious start to wonderful movements? One time, Eddie got as far away as Cleveland, Ohio, 35 miles, and called him up on the phone, collect, to let them know that he was going to commit suicide, but that he would give them time to drive up and witness the event. Well, they brought Eddie back one more time, and when Eddie sobered up, he had some other problems that hadn't immediately surfaced, and he began beating up on this little woman to whom he was married, and then he began chasing my mom around the house with a butcher knife. So we held a group conscience meeting. And it was decided the only thing to do with Eddie was for his little wife to take him back to Ann Arbor and recommit him in a mental institution. This was done. And Bill and Dad were crestfallen. Here's their first attempt to sober up another alcoholic together. Total failure. But I want to tell you folks something. At my dad's funeral 15 years later, a guy walked up to me and he said, "Do you know me?" And I said, "Yeah, I know you. You're Eddie." And he said, "That's right." And he said, "I want you to know I'm a member of the Youngstown, Ohio AA group, and I've been sober 1 year." We never know the result of that 12-step call, do we? I think our part of it is to take that hand that reaches out for help. I don't think we're responsible for the results. I think perhaps the results depend on our will of our Heavenly Father and perhaps the zeal of the person receiving the message. But our part is to take that hand that reaches out for help. And we don't know how long that may take to germinate. I made 12-step calls where the person that I called on obviously wished I wasn't there. Pretty soon I wished I wasn't there. But you got to remember, it's up our problem. Our part of it is to take this hand that reaches out for help. And thank God that the program was there when Betty and I needed it. so badly. You know, it's not what we add to the temple past, but how well we keep it green and alive. And that's what these old long-timers have done. They've kept the programs green and alive. Hospital beds were very expensive in those days. A double was $16 a day, and I think they're up a little now, but nobody had any dough. So they began taking these wet alcoholics into our home. And my dad, being the only medical man associated with this fledgling movement, would take a guy upstairs and say, "Now, I'm going to give you a shot of this whiskey, but I want you to take this medicine also." And it was a formaldehyde. And formaldehyde is a very pungent sedative. And so my sister and I, we were high school kids. When we opened the front door, if we smelled formaldehyde, we knew we'd lost our bed. But we didn't mind. This was recovery, folks. It was so much better. And you know, being teenagers, we liked action. And believe you me, there were lots of action bringing these wet drunks into the house, you know. And it was a happy time. And they weren't just overnight guests. Arch T went on and started AA in Detroit, stayed almost a year. He was that sick when he got there. But anyhow, this is the beginning. And of course, it was just a trickle. And I want to talk to you about somebody that nobody knows anything about, and I think that's the way she wanted it, my mom. Mom was a graduate of Wellesley, one of the fine women's colleges back in the East. And her great uncle was the president of the Santa Fe Railroad. And in those days, the railroad president had his own private car, and he could tie onto trains wherever trains went. And he took a liking to my mom and would take her around the country with him. So she got to kind of see the opulent side of life. My mom is a school teacher, and she'd led a very sheltered life. Was very easily shocked until AA. But you remember, AA wasn't just an instant success. It was thought of as a cult and a bunch of nuts, and we weren't very popular with the neighbors. If you want to get a feel for that one, try starting a halfway house in your home. We even got kicked out of the Presbyterian Church on account of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I never heard of anybody getting kicked out of the Presbyterian Church, but we were. So this was a beautiful lady that endured the snubs, and this was a lady that's on the telephone talking to people that wanted some information, and the wives and so forth. And this is a lady that was making the beds and cleaning up the messes and cooking the food. And yet, Mom realized right from the start that this was a disease that affected the whole family. And if I may, I would like to excerpt a letter and read it to you, parts of it. And let me tell you what this is. This is a letter that was written to Henry, by Henrietta Dodson, the wife of AA number 3, the man on the bed, you know, the Southern attorney. She's writing this letter to Bill Wilson. On Friday, June 28, 1935, I met Ann Smith. I'd met Dr. Bob on Thursday evening in the hospital. On Thursday evening when I went to the hospital to see my husband, Dr. Bob was there, and he said the little woman would like you to come over to the house. I told him I could not go that night, but would go the next night. And I skip a little bit. On Friday night when I went to the house on Ardmore Avenue, and that's our home, I met the most thoughtful, understanding person I have ever known. After talking with her for a while, I addressed her as Mrs. Smith, and she said, "Ann, to you, my dear." She wanted to remove all the barriers, and I skipped down here. Ann taught me to surrender myself to God and ask him if he had a plan for me, to reveal it to me. Ann taught me to have a quiet time in the morning that I might feel near to God and receive strength for the day. She taught me to surrender my husband to God and not to try and tell him how to stay sober, as I had tried that and failed. Ann taught me to love everyone. She said, "Ask yourself what is wrong with you today if I don't love you? She said, the love of God is triangular. It must flow from God, through me, through you, and back to God. She told me I should never criticize the remarks of the person leading the meeting, as we do not know God's plan. Maybe what that person says will meet the need of someone in the group. In the early part of 1936, Ann organized a woman's group for wives of alcoholics, whereby in her loving way she tried to teach us patience, love, and unselfishness. And I skip to the end now and said, when I met and talked with this intelligent, deeply spiritual woman, I was completely sold on A.A., Henrietta Dodson. So you see, Mom realized right from the word go that it was an illness that affected the whole family. And when Lois, our beloved, and Mom wrote to Lois that summer. And Lois came down from New York and stayed with us as long as she could that very first summer, but she had to get back to New York City. You got to realize Lois is the only one that had a job. But anyway, it started a friendship that ended only with Lois's death in recent years. And when Lois and a lady by the name of Ann B. wrote to all the known AA groups around the country to see if there was any interest in a program like our Al-Anon program, she found, to her surprise, that there were 64 groups already doing it. Independent thinking had realized that it was an illness that not only affected the alcoholic, but affected the loved ones of the alcoholic, and they were doing something about it. Bill wanted my mom to write the chapter to the wives and the family afterward, and she wouldn't do it. I don't know why, but she wouldn't do it. So he wrote them himself. Made Lois mad. And Lois collared him and said, hey, how come I didn't get to write it? Well, you know, we're not completely well. Bill said, well, the reason I did it that way, Lois, is I didn't want to spoil the continuity of the book. I don't think she bought that, but I want to tell you about my dad. You know, the pictures of him look so stern and grim, but he was a fun guy. He was a tall, thin Vermonter, and he had icy blue eyes, the kind that could look right through you. And a beautiful sense of wit and a beautiful sense of humor. When I brought my bride-to-be home in the 1940s for my folks to look her over prior to our marriage, my wife is tall and slender, and my dad looked her over, and he got me aside and said, she's built for speed and light housekeeping. And he was a man of relatively few words, but what he said were meaningful. And I want to tell you, a sex and hygiene lecture to me as a teenager. He got me up in the bathroom one day and closed the door, and I thought, oh, I'm going to find out all about it now. He said to me, flies spread disease, keep yours buttoned. He was an extremely brilliant man, and he had been force-fed a spiritual life. His folks were pillars of this Congregational Church there in St. Johnsbury, and they made him go every time the doors were open. And he had read the Bible from cover to cover 3 times, and he said, if I ever get out of that environment, I'm not going to darken the door of a church except on funerals and weddings. And he didn't for many years. But he had that knowledge, and I think this was so essential because, folks, these are spiritual programs. It's not a spiritual part. The whole programs are spiritual. One summer, I had an old Ford Roadster, and I had bought it for $12.50. And the reason it was so cheap, it didn't have a top. I didn't get the top with it. And Dad had some sort of an old dog of a car that was used a lot of gasoline and wasn't very reliable, and he said to me, He said, do you think this thing would go to Vermont and then on up into Quebec? And I had a high school buddy and we wanted to make a trip. And he said, well, let's take that old Ford. Do you think it'll make it? And I said, yeah, I think it'll make it, Dad, but it doesn't have a top. What are we going to do when it rains? He said, we're going to get wet. Yes. He was a great guy, lots of fun to be with. Of course, the elevator girls and the nurses and the doctors all saved their jokes for him, and he'd come home and try them on me, and I can see him just laughing till the tears ran down his cheeks, and he had to take his glasses off and wipe his eye. So he's not a stern guy like you see in the picture. He was a fun guy. You'd have loved him. And you young people would have loved him. He knew the slang of the day, and I'm not talking about the nasty four-letter words. But if Dr. Bob were living today, he'd know about cooling and weirding out and stroking. You know, he could talk to you young people. So anybody could talk to old Doc. He was a type that everybody liked. And as he left his office over to get his car, the kids at the central garage say, uh-oh, he's drunk. Let's take him home. So one of them would drive his car and another would follow in another car. And our garage was down under the house, see, so it was a pretty cozy thing. All we had to do was get him upstairs, and he'd pass out. He wasn't obstreperous drunk. He wasn't out thumbing his nose at the neighbors or doing anything, but he'd be passing out. And he desperately wanted to quit drinking. He desperately wanted to quit drinking. Anyway, AA just became a trickle, you know, just a few coming in until the media got a hold of it. First, the Cleveland Plain Dealer article, and then Jack Alexander's article, and the Saturday Evening Post. And so the miracles really started then. And the word got around that there was a doctor in Akron, Ohio, who could, quote, fix drunks. So they came in on the bus, on the train, dropped off by loving relatives, dropped off by relatives who weren't so loving. But again, I think our Heavenly Father provided the right person at the right time. Sister Ignatia was the admitting nurse at a Catholic hospital there in Akron, and she and my dad prevailed upon the Mother Superior to allow them to start a little alcoholic ward whereby people could be admitted with the disease of alcoholism for the first time. And it wasn't a big room, it was the flower room, you know, where they cut and arrange the flowers for the patients. And I've often thought, what did those guys think when they came to and there's nothing around them but flowers? But anyway, it was a start. And that facility is still in that hospital. It's not the flower room, it's the whole fifth floor. But it was a start where they could be admitted for the first time with the disease of alcoholism rather than some guys like gastroenteritis and so forth. So again, that was a start. You'd love Bill too. You know, Bill was a tall, thin Vermonter. They were born within 100 miles of each other, Bill in East Dorset and my dad in St. Johnsbury. Bill was garrulous. Bill was a visitor. I know some of you knew Bill. He loved to talk and he loved to visit. Bill was a promoter. Bill was a visionary. I think Bill Wilson could see further up the road than any human being I've ever known. Bill's mood swung. He was either high as a Georgia pine or low as a snake. You know, he never seemed to level out. My dad was just the opposite. He went along on a pretty steady keel. And these two guys fit together perfectly. And again, I think that was providentially arranged. Because, you know, folks, if any two of us are exactly alike, one of us is unnecessary. And I've often heard this said facetiously that if Alcoholics Anonymous had been left up to Dr. Bob Smith, it'd still be in Ohio. And if Alcoholics Anonymous had been left up to Bill Wilson, he'd have sold it to a franchise. Yeah. Did you ever think of the miracles that our Heavenly Father allowed to happen, whereby the first time alcoholics could be treated for the disease of alcoholism and recover? Let me just mention a few. You ever thought about this? Money. You know, Bill and Dan were broke, and they thought, oh, wouldn't it be great if we had some dough? We could establish treatment hospitals, and, you know, I'm sure my dad could see himself in his white coat greeting the patients, and maybe Bill out on the street flagging them in, you know. So they went to New York City to meet with some people with very deep pockets. And Mr. Rockefeller and his group investigated them and listened to them very carefully, and they came up with this decision. They said, no, money will ruin it. That's a miracle, folks. Now think what would have happened in your mind's eye if Mr. Rockefeller and his group had dumped $1 million on 100 broke alcoholics. It's just horrible to even think about, isn't it? I bet we wouldn't be sitting here today. Miracle. Anonymity. In the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, there were people with huge egos. Now, I know we don't have any of that anymore. But you can't be Mr. AA or Mrs. Al-Anon if nobody knows what your name is. And another thing that that has done, folks, it doesn't make any difference if you've been here 40 years or 40 days. We're all exactly the same. And isn't that the way it should be? Miracle. God, as we understood him, was put in the steps to quiet a loudmouth agnostic by the name of Jimmy B., who was from the East Coast and later California. And Jimmy said, this God stuff will ruin it. He said, it'll run him out faster than we can drag him in. So to quiet Jimmy down, they put God as we understood him. And you know what that has done? That has allowed these programs to be accepted by religions all over the world, all the Eastern religions, people who have an entirely different concept of a higher power than perhaps you and me. Just those words. Had to be a miracle. The big book of AA, you know, when it was first written, they couldn't give it away. It was in a bonded warehouse, and the guy wouldn't let them get any out until they paid him for it. They'd get 25 of them out, you know, and go out and sell them, and then they'd have enough for 35, you know. And it was not a popular book at all. Not a popular book at all. Now I understand it's the number two bestseller in the world, just behind the Holy Bible. Isn't that a miracle? And the beauty of it is the first 164 pages of text is basically the same as the first edition, except for one word. You know, Bill had a spiritual experience. It kind of came on him like a bowl of light. And most of us, I don't think, get it that way. We have to work at it. It's slow. So they changed the word having had a spiritual experience to having had a spiritual what? Awakening. And that's the only difference. And think of the millions of alcoholics that have tried to find a loophole in those first 164 pages. Somehow they managed to plug them all. My dad only lived 15 years. He was 15 years older than Bill when it started. But in that length of time, he personally treated, medically and AA-wise, over 5,000 alcoholics. And I like to think of my dad as Mr. 12-Step. Betty and I went to the first international in 1950. And this is the one where they adopted the 12 traditions. And this is so important. My dad went there and gave a short talk, and there's only two talks recorded of Dr. Bob, and that's one of them. It was very short. He was very, very ill and dying. But they adopted the 12 traditions unanimously. Six guys got up, and each read two, and The convention adopted them unanimously, and I think this is so necessary because this is the glue that holds us together, folks. Bill had gone around the country, you know, in the 1940s, late 40s, stumping for the tradition, and groups were then like they are now, and they said, oh, Bill, go on back to New York and run that like you want to. We'll run this here like we want to, and they wouldn't pay any attention to it. Well, some guy had called up Bill or wrote him from North Carolina, said, Bill, we got to do something. We're getting to be like the Washingtonians. Well, 160 years ago, six alcoholics from Baltimore decided that they wanted to stop drinking, and they started a group which was known as the Washingtonians, and they had the idea of total abstinence. They had group meetings, they visited each other's meetings, and it really went over 10 times faster than AA. People signed pledges, and I have a book at home, shows there's 250,000 of them in Ohio alone. But they got to thinking, oh, this is so great for alcohol. This is wonderful for everything. So they just splintered off, and they just flew to pieces. And 12 years later, they were gone. And I'll tell you how far gone they were. Bill had to go to the library and find out who the Washingtonians were. Well, you see, that was beginning to happen to AA. Between 1942 and 1945, AA started to self-destruct. There were people putting out their shingles as AA's official representative, counselor. They were establishing official AA hospitals. They were incorporating Alcoholics Anonymous in different states. And it was obviously what was happening to them was what happened to the Washingtonians. So thank God these 12 traditions were written and adopted. And Betty and I attended the Second International in St. Louis in 1955. See, my dad had died. Mom died in the 49, and Dad was sick and lonely, and we drove him back to his beloved Vermont one more time. And I wouldn't take for the time that we had sharing with each other as we rode along and sat on this edge of the bed at night. But we brought him back to Akron, Ohio, and at the time I had a flying job out of Dallas. And I had to leave, and I never saw my dad alive again. But we did have that wonderful time together. Well, Bill was always kind to us, and he invited Betty and I to attend the Second International in 1955. And this is the one where he turned AA over to the AAs. And also, this is the one where the religious leaders who had loved AA when AA wasn't cool gave talks, Dr. Sam Shoemaker and Father Ed Dowling. And fortunately for all of us, those talks are recorded in the book, AA Comes of Age, a chapter, Religion Looks at AA, if any of you are interested. So we got to see that, and these things were so important because other attempts to sober up alcoholics usually died because the founders died or left town or there was no structure. Now here, both things are in place. And that's one reason I think we've survived. The succession of the founders was provided for. We had our structure. And so we've been able to survive. And those things, I think, are absolutely important, very important to us. Well, we didn't attend another one for quite a few years. You know, Betty and I were party animals. And we loved to dance and drink and I tell you, I sure wasn't telling anybody that my dad was Dr. Bob Smith. But once in a while, somebody would find it out and invite us to a meeting. And we would go to a meeting and enjoy it. And as we drove home, we'd say, oh, good for them. They needed that. I understand Betty had poured her dad in a drying out place in Denver in the 1940s, and he and another guy started Alcoholics Anonymous in the state of New Mexico. So if there was ever two human beings that should have known about alcoholism, it was my wife and I. But we didn't. You see, we thought we were different. Yeah, we thought we were different. And, you know, we didn't immediately, after we saw we had a problem, we didn't say, oh, this is our lifetime realization. Betty, you're going to get to join AA. Wow. And Bob, you can join Al-Anon. This is our what we've wanted for and dreamed of all our life. It wasn't that the way it happened. Let me tell you a little story. I think this describes it. Two hunters love to hunt way up in the north woods of Alaska. And they would hire a plane to bring them into a little lake and then pick them up a week later. So the little plane came in, and one of the hunters said, "Oh, we're glad to see you. We had a wonderful hunt. We got three moose." And the pilot thought, "Three moose? You two guys, me and three moose in this little airplane? I don't think it'll fly." One of the hunters said, "Don't worry about it." He said, "We had a plane come in here just exactly like yours last year. We had three moose, and what he did was he taxied up the river and got a longer run for the takeoff, and we didn't have any trouble getting in the air." Well, the pilot thought, "Well, I'm new in the company. I guess I've got to try it." And so he did that, and sure enough, the little plane takes off, and they start back to civilization. But the engine is working so hard, it begins to overheat, and then it loses power, and way out in the middle of nothing, they crash. And one of the hunters drags his buddy out from under the plane and kind of dusts him off. And his buddy said, "Oh, where in the world are we?" And the other one said, "You know, I think we're within 100 yards of where we crashed last year." And that's the way our life was going, trying the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. Well, when it finally got bad enough, Betty's mother was staying with us, and she said to me, "Tell her you want a divorce, that'll shock her." And so I did. And boy, was I disappointed. It didn't shock her near as much as I thought it ought to. What I didn't realize was that the disease of alcoholism became the number one priority, as it must, and the family moved down the line. But anyway, she finally got desperate enough, and as it often happens, a young guy called up and said, "Betty, we're starting a group here in Nocona, Texas, for people that have a problem like you and me. Will you come?" And she did. And he and that guy and one other guy founded the group there. And she quit cold turkey, hanging on by her fingernails. She you know, just had a terrible time. She said, "Sometimes I wanted to go in the closet, just knock my head against the wall." She said, I don't recommend that you quit that way, but she said, "I'll tell you one thing, you darn sure won't forget it." But she never did take another drink for the balance of her life. Well, I want to tell you that I watched her, and she was running off and leaving me. It was a program of attraction. She was learning stuff and changing, and it was some stuff that I thought I would like to know. So once someone said to me, "Well, Bob, why don't you join Al-Anon?" And I thought, why not? I don't mind joining the auxiliary. So I got in my car and I drove 40 miles over to Gainesville, Texas, and I walk into my first Al-Anon group meeting, and I look around, and I'm the only guy. And I got mixed emotions immediately about Al-Anon. And I like to describe mixed emotions this way. It's kind of like the feeling you get when your teenage daughter comes in at 4 a.m. with a Gideon Bible under her arm. But I stayed, and I bless those ladies. They listened to me patiently, and I do think you need to listen to a new person once. And I left there knowing that I had just done a marvelous job. You know, the rock that this family had been hanging on to, you know, bloody but unbowed. But these things are revealed to us, you know, as we can handle them. Later on, a couple of years later, I talked to Ann about it and said, "Oh, yeah, Bob, I remember when you came to that first meeting." said, after you left, we held a meeting. And they said, boy, there's one that's not going to make it. And not a one of them would volunteer to sponsor me either. So, but I thank the Lord for those good women, and I consider that my home group. And I've been glad to be with those people ever since. And the things I have learned, you know, these are such happy programs. I had to learn that our relationship didn't have to be 50-50. Sometimes it's 90-10, sometimes it's 10-90, and what's the difference? It'll all balance out. Sometime Betty would get on a dry drunk. Sometimes Bob would get on a dry. And if it happened at the same time, there were periods of quiet. You know, ask your father to pass the salt. But fortunately, our programs would draw us back, the strength. I had to learn that I can easily slip back into do the bad things I used to do. I can do that very easily. One of the most profound statements I've ever heard anybody make in the program was a lady from Albuquerque, New Mexico. And she said this, and I want to pass it on to you. She said, the person I was will drink again. How true. The person I was will drink again. So we have to keep working our program and not let ourselves slide back. The Al-Anon, the person I was can get that sick again. I know how to do it. It's easy to do. So I have to constantly keep progressing, and sometimes it's scary, but there are some marvelous views and marvelous scenery if you just keep on with your program progressing all the time. And we had four kids, and I want to pass this around to some of you young people that might help you with your marriage. We had this pact that whoever walked away from the marriage first got the kids. Boy, that'll see you through some rough ones. I got to learn about honesty. In my opinion, honesty has different levels. You know, I think that there's cash register honesty. You know, that's the girl gives you too much change, you say, oh, here, you gave me too much money, and you walk out, and you're so proud of yourself. That's one level. Then I think there's what I call resume honesty. You know, you basically tell the truth, but you gussy it up a little bit. Touch it up a little bit because you want people to like you or whatever. And that's the second degree. And then I think that there's the program honesty, absolute honesty. When I can talk to you and show you just what I am, warts and all, and you do the same for me, we can have an instant, intimate relationship. And I know of no other organizations in which you can do that. It doesn't make any difference in our age or where we come from, anything. If we can be totally honest with each other, we can have an instant, intimate relationship. And for me, that spells loneliness, dispels loneliness. And most people go through this life lonely. But we have that facility to stop that. What a blessing. And the God that I understand today, I was raised in the Episcopal Church. You know, that's Catholic light. You know, all the pageantry without the guilt. But God was used to improve my deportment, you know. If you do this, he's going to get you. So to keep me, you know, more or less on track, he was used to improve my deportment, and I didn't really like that. And I was a bomber pilot, and I flew 45-minute missions out of Africa in World War II, and our losses were 50%. And I had another relationship with God. I had a 911 relationship. Deals with God. Did any of you ever do that? Make a deal, evil God, if you'll do this, I've never, ever again, you know. But that wasn't a very satisfactory one. But due to this program, the relationship that I understand that works for me now is that God is a heavenly Father, that we're all God's kids, and He wants us to do better. And I talk to my God all the time, just like I can talk to you. Driving down the road, God, did you see that SOB cut us off? That's the kind of a beautiful relationship that I have with my Heavenly Father now. Well, everything was just going along great. All the kids were married that wanted to be and divorced that wanted to be. You know, everything was pretty smooth. One had a bachelor's degree, two had master's, one had his doctorate. We were just going along beautifully. Betty with her AA program and me with my Al-Anon. You know, our programs are not the same, but they're parallel. And I got a phone call. My number one son, my oldest son, Scott had a master's degree cum laude from the University of Texas, and he was a member of Mensa, you know, the people with the genius IQ. Had a wife, three kids, a great job, money was no problem, booze and drugs were no problem. He was a top BMW salesman in Dallas. Something happened at work, I guess it was a corporate stress, and he went out in his car and sat down and pulled out his gun and blew his brains out. What a terrible shock. You know, no parent wants to outlive their kids. And this was a terrible shock to us. But what I want to tell you is that our program and the people in it took us in their hands and propped us up until we could stand alone. And that's one of the beauties of our program. 6 months later, my beautiful wife, Betty, was diagnosed with terminal lung cancer. And she, fortunately, we were able to have her die at home, free of pain and in bed. And she went through it beautifully. I dragged her all around the country, you know, and she finally said to me, I know what you're trying to do, honey, but I'm not afraid to die. Said, I release you. And I said, okay, honey, I'll release you. So she passed away. We were married 53 years. And again, the program and the people in it gathered us up and held us in their arms and propped us up until we could stand, until I could stand alone again. And I tell you this because this is life on life's terms, folks. And you know, we're all going to have to live life on life's terms. It's not going to always be just smooth sailing. But thank God we have these programs to take care of us and so that we can handle these things without just totally flying apart. So if you're new here and you think that you're just starting from absolutely nothing, so did these programs. If you think that you're badly in need of a miracle, you've got to realize that our Heavenly Father has seen to it a series of miracles that has allowed it to grow in my lifetime from two guys to people all over the world in, what, 140 different countries in my lifetime. And most of us sitting in this room are absolute miracles. So please don't shy away from us. Talk to us. We love to hear from you. You don't bother us. You strengthen us. So talk to us, you know, and hang in there with us because, you know, you've still got your miracle coming. Don't you quit before your miracle. Thank you.